All right, let me mention that our second case on the calendar, Brand Insulation versus Brandis. We're going to give the parties 15 minutes per side on that matter, just so you're aware, and the people following are also aware. Our first case, State of Washington versus Velez Morrow. Parties ready?
Good morning, Your Honors. Jennifer Winkler on behalf of John Velez Morrow. We're asking that this court reverse the sentencing court's restitution order. We are operating under the Washington statute in this case.
Would you like to reserve any time?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
Very well.
Thank you for reminding me. We're operating under 994A-753-3, not the federal statute in this case. And that provides that, except as provided in subsection 6 of this section, restitution ordered by a court shall be based on easily ascertainable damages, and then it lists a couple different categories. I would argue there's three different categories. For injury to or loss of property is the first one. Two, actual expenses incurred for treatment for injury to persons, and three, lost wages resulting from injury. And then there's a section at the end that says we're not talking about mental anguish, pain and suffering, or other intangible losses, but may include the cost of counseling reasonably related to the offense. And I would argue that's not a fourth category. That's really within the second category because it's akin to a medical expense. And all of these, what the cases have said, every single case that I've looked at says that Washington law interpreting our general purpose restitution statute under the SRA requires but-for causation proved by the state by a preponderance of the evidence.
Has the issue ever been squarely put that, as to whether that is the only way of establishing causation?
Well, the courts have had a lot of chances to back down from that. There's been certainly a deep inquiry into whether this is consistent with our policy that the restitution statute be broadly interpreted. And then in Harris, for example, this court looked at some other states' restitution schemes and said, you know what, those are too strict and we're going to go with but-for causation because that strikes the proper balance here. It's permissive enough to meet the broad interpretation requirement and the goals of the restitution statute, but we're still going to require but-for causation.
Was the court asked to decide whether or not a substantial factor test would be appropriate in that case?
No, I don't believe so, but I don't believe that a substantial factor would be the requirement under Paroline either, under the Supreme Court's test. It's not even a substantial factor test.
Isn't the idea of Paroline an idea borrowed from tort law, which is that in circumstances where it's unfair to the plaintiff, or especially where there are a whole bunch of different defendants and a whole lot of different culpable entities, that but-for causation may not be the only method of causation. We have several tort cases. It doesn't come up very often, but it does come up often enough so that we know that there are several different ways, market share, substantial factor, of reaching a just decision on causation, where otherwise strictly but-for doesn't really work.
Right, but Paroline, yeah, there was a lot of, Paroline's a very fractured case, and it seems to me that Paroline, the justices said, well, we're going to go with what seems fair to us. It doesn't even seem like they really followed the tort law causation cases either. They give you these.
So you think the Supreme Court was it the Supreme Court?
They were splitting the baby, I think.
You think they were just being sloppy and, you know, not a decision that would be entitled to any deference?
I think that it's a limited decision, and they have the luxury of making it a limited decision based on the way that the statutory restitution scheme is set up in the federal system.
Because our statute uses the word result. It doesn't even use the word but-for.
Yeah, it does.
And don't you think that it's fair to say that some damages resulted to this victim from your client's possession of that series of pornography?
I don't think that's been proven here because there's no indication that she knew about my client. I think this is an attorney-driven...
Would you agree that the activity that your client was involved in by possessing this pornography as well as the activity in combination with the activities of the other possessors was a cause of injury to the victim in this case?
Yes, but we're getting further and further and further down the line here.
Well, but the activity he engaged in was a cause of the injury. The question is, how do you apportion it? Isn't that
right.
The issue?
Right, and I think that is the issue, but I think it doesn't fit within our restitution statute and our previous jurisprudence on the restitution statute. I think this is a fine. I think that's what's been levied here, and I don't think the legislature has seen fit yet, perhaps, to require a fine here, because we have a couple of, and that goes to my second argument, that this is an arbitrary amount, because we have, okay, here's counseling expenses divided by the square root of pi, and okay, $5,000. Oh, okay, that's not right. We don't allow that in Washington. Or maybe I'm just going to say that we're not going to, you know, we're only going to go from April of 2013 forward. Okay, so we're going to take the federal amount, and we're going to divide it by
some requirement that it be restitution be precisely determined?
No, but it needs to be, I believe the term is, a reasonable basis for estimating the loss and does not require the court to base its award on speculation or conjecture, and that's Griffith. And so when we have, I think I point out in the brief, when we have a request made in February, and we have this calculation, okay, $5,000. Then we have a totally different calculation going on in April, and guess what? It's also $5,000. That sounds like a fine to me. That sounds like something the legislature...
But we know what her damages are.
We know what our damages are.
We know they did the 17% of the total remaining unpaid damages is equivalent to the amount that would be allowable under the law in the state of Washington, right?
Well, but why are we looking at that total amount? Why are we looking at that as the benchmark, the federal?
Because,
and why are we attributing all...
Because there's not another way to determine it. That's why.
So we're looking at imposing a $5,000 fine on him that doesn't change no matter what calculation we come up with. And that doesn't seem to me to fit within the restitution statute as we know it. And maybe there needs to be another mechanism because there are harms that are going on. We don't have a cause in fact or a but-for causation going on here because there's no evidence that she knew anything about Mr. Velez Moro.
Why does she have to know anything about him? I mean, people are victims of crimes without knowing who did it. Still, they experience harm. You don't have to know your burglar, your murderer, your rapist.
But under the restitution statute, we're not under the Victims Compensation Act. We're under the restitution statute under the SRA. This
even
is a...
So. I don't get where you're coming from in terms of saying, well, she didn't know him.
I'm going with what the previous cases said, and that's but for, and that's my first argument. My second argument is that this is an arbitrary number. So if you don't like my first argument, I think my second argument is also persuasive, Your Honor, which is that this is essentially a fine, and it's arbitrary, and it's up to the legislature to set such a fine.
All right. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Don Porter. I'm a senior deputy prosecutor for King County representing the state. It's always a pleasure to appear before you, but I've been particularly looking forward to this morning's argument. It's my opportunity to argue an important case. It is a case of first impression in the state, and it is on behalf of child victims of sexual exploitation. I think we all intuitively understand, and this case, the record demonstrates conclusively, that these victims suffer horrible emotional and psychological trauma. In this case, Vicky, which is obviously a pseudonym for a very real person, was abused by her father between the ages of 5 and 13. And the abuse was almost entirely for commercial purposes from the beginning. And that is so important because the whole theory of responsibility in this case is it's a market-driven crime. One of the most egregious facts in this case, for me anyway, is that the men on the other end of the internet, so to speak, while Vicki was being abused by her father, essentially were calling in orders, dialing up the perversions that they wanted to see Vicki undergo for their own purposes. So, yeah, this is sick stuff. And these victims suffer dreadfully, sometimes for life.
Well, I don't think it's disputed that the activities that Mr. Velez-Morrow and those who engaged in similar activity, that caused some harm to the victim in this case. I think the more pertinent question is whether or not the state is able to establish that there is a causation as to Mr. Velez-Morrow. And I appreciate you sort of directing your comments to that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. You know, we're very fortunate to have the authority of Paroline, which investigated this very set of circumstances and found that the but-for causation or cause-in-fact test that is typically applied in criminal cases is not appropriate under the circumstances of the possession of child pornography crime. And I've given the formulation in my briefing that the Paroline Court used, but it is essentially that when one or more persons together collectively are the but-for cause, in fact, of the injuries of a victim, but when application of that standard would serve to absolve all of them, then they are each a cause, in fact, of the damages. And so that was borrowed from tort law. All of the cases cited by my opposing counsel here are just standard sort of criminal cases where the but-for cause test was perfectly applicable in Washington criminal cases. But
I'm not sure really why, and I don't know whether you're taking it for granted that the but-for causation test doesn't really work here. I mean, Mr. Velez-Morrow, along with apparently thousands of other people, collectively engaged in purchasing activity, which is illegal, and but for their participation as a group in this consumer market, there would not have been this abuse, arguably, I think one could say, because, as you say, it was done for commercial purposes. So it's not the usual one-on-one but-for test, but it still seems to me that, in a sense, the but-for causation test is not absent here.
That's exactly what the Paroline majority found. But for the market for the images, the abuse would not have occurred. And the problem with the application of the individual but-for standard is it's impossible to determine any marginal harm suffered by Vicki because Mr. Velez-Morrow had 8 images when presumably thousands of men have engaged in
and arguably she would have suffered the same harm even if Mr. Velez-Morrow had not done his
correct
activity.
Now, it is important to understand that in Paroline there was a stipulation that the victim, Amy, had been unaware that defendant, Paroline, had possessed any of her images. He possessed 2 images, and that wasn't material to the court's holding, just like here. You know, we don't have to prove that Vicki was aware of Mr. Velez-Morrow having the 8 images.
And so, could you respond to counsel's argument that, in essence, the amount that was chosen here was like a fine because it just seemed to be taken out of the air and not generated by any rational process that one might be able to duplicate in another case?
And counsel for Mr. Velez-Morrow, I think, is in the unenviable position of arguing the dissent in Paroline. That's the dissent argument. But it's not a persuasive argument because the Paroline majority says that the goal here is to, through the application of judgment and discretion by the trial court, to assign a relative causal figure for the individual defendant's contribution. And there's all sorts of recognition throughout the opinion that that is not something that is susceptible to any sort of mathematical precision. But what Vicki's attorney, Carol Hepburn, who's president in court, did for the trial court was to give the trial court hundreds of pages of documentation that establishes the overall injuries. And she separated the injuries that would be recoverable in federal court from those that are allowable in Washington. And there's a significant distinction. There are certain categories not allowed in Washington that can be recovered in federal court, primarily future lost wages, litigation expenses, attorney's fees. So Ms. Hepburn provided...
And personal injury, pain, and suffering, that's not allowable, right?
Right.
This figure does not include that.
No, this figure includes only proven past lost wages and counseling expenses. And so the
Let's say that part is reasonable. I mean, it makes sense. There's 17% and 17%, so we've now got a solid number. How do you, out of that number, how do you then say, you know, out of the unknown number of people who have possessed these images, that Mr. Velez-Moro is responsible for this amount?
Yes. So I will just use some more figures to demonstrate what happened in this case. So the figure that was decided to be the unrecovered Washington amount was $66,000. The figure asked for on behalf of Vicki was $5,000, less than 10%. Now, the record at the trial court includes during oral argument the fact that there had only been one other order in the state of Washington on Vicki's behalf. So we do have that factor, and that's one of the factors recommended by the Paroline majority for courts to be considering. Nonetheless, you know, it's a round number, 5,000. Counsel argues it sounds like a fine. It's not a fine. It's going to go directly to the aid of Vicki. It is not going into the state's coffers, and it is sufficient in this case. There was an application of discretion by the trial court in determining the defendant's relative causal role to come up with a figure that is less than 10% of damages. And throughout Paroline, there's recognition over and over again that you can't come up with a mathematical figure. It would have been, frankly, disingenuous had counsel asked for $4,987. That would perpetrate this idea that somehow you can reach a precise mathematical formulation of what Vicki suffered because of Mr. Velez-Moro's role.
I mean, the idea in Paroline was that it should not be, whatever the amount was, it should not be severe and should not be a token.
That's, I mean, exactly the line.
I'm thinking as a trial judge trying to figure out what that means, and that's a lot of discretion in picking a number, and I'm wondering if that's just maybe too broad under Washington statute.
I think that is very important language. It's not to be severe. It's not to be a token or a nominal amount. But I think we do have to recognize and get comfortable with the fact that the Paroline decision was in some significant part policy-driven. It is just the right thing to do to compensate these victims with restitution in these cases. And so they came up with an approach that is going to be heavily dependent on the application of the trial court's discretion. There is no question about that. And I would say that on this record, the trial court was exceedingly careful. Ms. Hepburn, on behalf of the victim, was very thorough. She made a very reasoned argument in distinguishing the damages that would be available in Washington. And the figure is just. It holds. There were two factors at the Paroline court stressed for the policy behind this approach. Number one is that the victim will be compensated this way. And secondly, every defendant who possesses child pornography will be made to understand the impact of their crimes, that there are very real victims out there that have suffered tremendous damages. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think, as this court acknowledges, there's no evidence Mr. Velez-Moro was ordering any of the acts here.
You had made a comment earlier that you felt that this thing was attorney-driven, and I don't know exactly what you meant by that, but do you happen to know from the record what the total compensation for Vicki has been through the United States?
I believe it is in Ms. Hepburn's second letter, the April letter, and I think it's around $700,000. So, and that's at CP Clerk's Paper 89, something like that. The first letter is Clerk's Paper, like 64, 65, then we're looking at like 87 to 89. So there's no evidence that he was ordering the acts here. We're getting farther and farther in time away. There's no evidence how he came upon this, if it was a purchase, if it So we're just talking about a person who is found to be, just like the court to step back a second, this is someone who is amenable to treatment. I know no one wants to hear about the perpetrators in these cases, but that's my client, and that's the person who has a problem and was found to be amenable to treatment. And when you throw random numbers.
Isn't restitution part of that is accountability?
It is part of
his rehabilitation. Is it not being accountable for what he did?
It is, but we have to, under Paroline, look at, it's actually supposed to be not, gosh, this feels right, and I know in my gut this is the right number. Paroline actually has a more careful calculation. The Supreme Court had the luxury of not having to do it, but it does set forth a careful calculation. That we don't have here. We have the Supreme, or we have at 14 RP, the trial, or the Superior Court judge saying, we've got uncompensated losses. Under the federal system, we've got uncompensated losses. We've got uncompensated losses. Mathematically precise, it's not. And I know this court I know that the restitution cases, they always seem to say two things. It needs to be a reasonable basis, doesn't have to be mathematically precise. But when you start to say things like that, it sounds like good enough for government work. And that's not, that can't be right. There has to be a certain balancing under Paroline. But I would argue that Paroline does not apply. And I think this court should look at page 727 of the Supreme Court cite in Paroline. And it cites a case, Burrage. And Burrage actually stands for the proposition, and that's Burrage's 134 Supreme Court at 888, courts need not read phrases like results from to require but-for causality where there is textual or contextual reason to conclude otherwise. And so what Paroline is actually saying, what the majority in that case is saying, is that when we look at the purposes of this restitution scheme in the federal system, we have textual and contextual reason to conclude otherwise. So you start with the statute, and that's exactly what we do in Washington. We start with the statute, and the statute is a general purpose restitution statute, and the courts have held that but-for causation is necessary.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.